The wait is over. Parish of the Patriots is back. Glad to have you with us once again for the 139th installment of the show, if you can believe that, 139. We're spiraling towards 150. I don't know if we're spiraling downwards or maybe upwards. Hopefully, things are getting better at the show, but things in society are definitely getting worse. This show is supported by the financial voluntary support of you, the listeners. If you get something out of the show, your voluntary support, financial support is very much appreciated. Don't be shy. Pay those tithes. You can find that information at the bottom of the description page. We got snail mail. We got Bitcoin. Got Monero. Drop me a note. I got my email address down there. If you have a weirdo cryptocurrency, let me know. I'll do my best to get you an address for that. So without further ado, with all of that out of the way, we'll get right into the listener supporter mailbag, because no doubt we are on a clock here. We have a limited amount of time. We got a long way to go and a short time to get there, as a wise man once said. Anyway, let's see here. We got a note from Daniel with something to pass on to the network, to Sven. So I'll get that taken care of. Mr. TGPD, just a little dough for the show. It is very much appreciated. Every bit helps. This is from Tony. Hey, Dan. I thought you might like this writing. There was an included writing in there. And yes, it was very interesting. I looked through that. Very much appreciated. Triangle Whip, I may see many Holocaust deniers in heaven. Jesus is the truth. And, you know, there, for such a short statement, it is something to reflect on, the fact that the truth cannot be hidden forever. The truth cannot be held down, cannot be covered up forever. And you're absolutely right. Jesus is truth. Amen to that. Jesus is the truth. And, yes, the truth at some point in time surfaces back up. I was thinking of the absurdity of the story, which I'm sure you've all heard or read by now, of the 96-year-old woman that they're hunting down in Germany because when she was a teenager, she was a secretary at one of the labor camps. And, you know, she's guilty of the however many, the number seems kind of vague now. It's just escapes my mind. She's somehow now complicit because she was making coffee and taking shorthand notes. She's complicit in the death of the 6 million. But, yeah, and I was reading these stories. I was reading the story on you know, fairly, I think it was like on RT. I was reading about the story. And, you know, you have like normie comments. You read this new story on, there's very few news outlets that allow comments, you know. And it's pretty, I don't know if you want to say pretty bad, pretty good. But when you read through normie content, and normies are even like, you know, I think this is enough. You know, you're chasing some 96-year-old woman out of the nursing home to put her on trial for murder of the 6 million and because she was a secretary. Even normies are like, you know, that probably believe in, you know, wooden door gas chambers or whatever. They're even like, you know, enough is enough. I mean, at what point in time do we quit hounding people? But it never ends. This is from Andy. Science is a tool, and people who worship science are even bigger tools. I've reached a point where anytime someone says I believe in science or accuses someone else of lacking critical thinking skills, I just instantly know that they're retarded. Don't get me wrong, I actually do really like science. I was a university researcher in a STEM-related field for several years. But if years ago the government mandated that everyone got a lobotomy, every one of these clowns would be falling over themselves to run out and get one, just because the long-term effects hadn't been established yet. Yes, the long-term effects. Our studies show, our data shows, we have no reason to believe. I love the weasel words they're using right now. You know, we're talking about people that do the whole, I follow the science. I believe in the science. It's virtue signaling. Nothing more. I believe in the science. What's wrong with you? The science. Don't you believe in the science? It is their new God. It really is. It's not an overstatement. It's not. I'm just not simply using over-the-top rhetoric when I say this quote-unquote science that they're talking about is a religion. And people, the priests wear white coats or just fancy business suits. You have the average person who will say, I believe in science. I follow the science. I believe in the science. What they actually mean is they believe the media. And that's one of the best responses that I have and the best attitude to take. It's laughable. I believe in the, what do you? You don't believe in the vax? You don't believe in all of the stories in the ultimate death of the COVID? I believe in the science. What's wrong with you? But the correct response is you believe in the media. There's no shortage of experts, PhDs, experts in the field, scientists who say this is all a bunch of bullshit. There's no shortage of those people. So, but they're kicked out of, they're not considered part of the high priesthood of science. The idiot, the average midwit who postures about how they love science and they're smarter than you, they just believe the media. They believe what's on the media. They don't believe the science. There's no science really involved here. They're just a bunch of gobbledygook at this point. They believe the media. They don't believe the scientists that have been banned from YouTube for saying this is all a bunch of bullshit. They don't count. They believe the hand-picked ones that promote the narrative on the media, on CNN, on MSNBC. Anthony Fauci, he's like the Pope of the science. It isn't science. There's no science to it. You watch the wiggle words they use. I love watching the wiggle words they use. You know, should pregnant women get the vaccine? We have no, what about pregnant women? What about people who are concerned that this vaccine could affect their fertility? And they'll say, we have no reason to believe with the knowledge that we currently have that there's any long-term effects as far as fertility goes. Weasel words. These are lawyer words so that later if it all blows up in their faces, they can say, no. Let's take a look at, let's parse the words that I said. I didn't say there was absolutely nothing going to happen. I said I had no reason to believe at this time by the data that we currently have. When people go on about the vaccine, your perfect response is show me the long-term data. They cannot. There is no long-term study. Show me the long-term study. You are the long-term study. It's interesting because people who have gotten this, now that were going to voluntarily get it, now they're working on the holdouts, you know? The people that were going to be convinced. The people who are going to be convinced. I saw a story the other day in the media. And yes, we're just merging right on in here from the listener supporter mailbag into the rest of the show. So thank you, all of you who financially support the show. Yeah, I saw a deal on the story the other day, and they were talking about what works better, you know, incentives to get the vaccine or mandates. In other words, what's better approach, the carrot or the stick? And in their story, they basically wound up saying the stick is better. You're going to get a better response if you threaten to fire people from their jobs. I saw a story, some hospitals now are denying people organ transplants unless they get the COVID vaccine. Now let's unpack that for a minute. Stop. Let's think about what is actually being said here. If you're in bad enough health that you got to have an organ transplant, then that means you're on a clock. If you don't get the organ transplant, then you're going to die. So they're saying that they're going to sentence you to death because they're going to refuse to do the organ transplant unless you get the COVID vaccine. And their explanation is because if you don't have the COVID vaccine, you'll have a greater chance of death. Let that sink in for a minute. They're literally sentencing people to die now by refusing to give them the procedure they need unless they get the vaccine. Because the COVID is deadly or something, even though it has a over 99% survival rate. They're going to sentence you to a 100% death by denying your organ transplant. It's the truth. It sits there, you let it sink in. It's so outrageous, and it is outrageous. But I've said nothing here that isn't the truth. If you unpack, get rid of their gibberish they throw at you to try to confuse you, to try to stir up and muddy the waters. They're saying they're going to sentence you to death if you don't get the vaccine. But we're only doing it because we're worried that you might have a greater chance of dying without the vaccine. We're going to give you a 100% chance of dying by refusing your organ transplant, 100% chance of death. But because if you don't have the vaccine, you know, you have a 0.007 or whatever the hell chance of death. Does it make any logical sense? Of course it doesn't, because they're lying to you. It doesn't make sense because they're absolutely lying to you. They lie. They lie to us all the time. They've always lied to us. But see, the difference is the lies, say 70, 80 years ago, they were actually, you know, better constructed. Like they put a little more effort into it. They've piled so many. A liar always has to pile more lies to cover up the lies that they told before. So now maybe it's not that these people doing the lying now are just more stupid than people before. Maybe it's just that they've piled so many lies on top of other lies that we've reached the inevitable point of absurdity with The inevitable point of absurdity when it comes to the lies. When people start really realizing, waking up, as it were, and understanding how much they've been lied to. You know, it's just a moment to where it, like, their whole world just shatters and changes. And then, of course, it's easy to get swept up into, you know, believing everything is a lie. But I don't know, so many things they tell us now, they just are. I mean, you got to have something. I don't think the earth is secretly flat or anything absurd like that. But pretty much everything coming from the government is a lie on one form or the other. One of the things I find amazing is the way the media and the government, like, work just hand in hand. I mean, just absolute hand in hand. And yet you still have people out there that act like they're separate, you know, they're separate entities. I think about, you know, people talk about, you know, this idea they have about whistleblowers, you know. Imagine if you were in the government. You know, because you've watched movies, you know, and somebody's working inside of a government agency and they uncover this, you know, secret, horrible plot. And they, you know, there's all this drama where they're sneaking the papers out or the information of the computer flash drive, whatever the case may be, you know, and they get it out. And what do? They go to a reporter and they get it to the press and they blow the lid off the scandal. Can you imagine working in a government agency now and trying to blow the lid off the scandal? What report are you going to go to? They're all working for the government at some form or another. Maybe not directly, but they are. They're working for the government. You're going to go to people and say, oh, well, if this or that was a hoax, somebody would have told it by now. They probably did, but the media just doesn't report it because they're on the same team. They have the same bosses. They answer to the same board of directors. I would say politicians are nothing more than middle management. You really have to understand. If you understand nothing else, understand politicians are middle management. And part of middle management's job is to field customer complaints. Imagine what a shitty job that is in a way. They're paid well. I don't feel sorry for them. But it is a shitty job. A politician's job is to field customer complaints. They're customer service. They're the ones that are supposed to take the heat, but they're not running the show. They answer to the board of directors. Guess what? The media answers to the same board of directors. If you're working in a government agency and you uncover something devious that the board of directors is doing and you go to the media so they can blow the lid off the scandal, guess what? Nothing's going to happen. Nobody's going to hear about it. They're on the same team. They answer to the same board of directors. I thought a good example of this past week, their story, the Pandora Papers. You probably read about this. You probably heard something, at least heard about it in passing. This release of documents, just so happened a release of documents, it was handy, that has a just shocking revelation that billionaires are hiding their money in offshore accounts and aren't paying taxes. For some reason, they have all these pictures of these people and they're foreigner. You know, they got a picture of Putin up there. I'm pretty sure Putin isn't paying any U.S. taxes. It's supposed to be this shocking, shocking revelation. Billionaires don't pay taxes. And what a shock. We just segue right from that into now the government is saying that they want to enact it to where any deposit you make in your bank account of a whopping $600 gets automatically reported to the IRS. And this is the justification. What's the justification for this? Well, we had this release of documents. These billionaires aren't paying their taxes. We want to be sure they're paying their fair share. So we're going to make sure that your little side hustle that pays cash, when you go to deposit that $600, buddy, we're cracking down. Jeff Bezos is going to suddenly start paying a bunch of his wealth in taxes by cracking down on you mowing lawns and collecting $600. It's absurd. It's stupid. But you see how they work hand in hand. The media releases the story. The government comes in and says, we'll fix this. I remember when they pass it. And what do? They use past justifications. Once again, this ties back to the failed, you know, the fake, horrible war on drugs that they've used as justification for all sorts of criminal behavior. They use the war on drugs. If you make a $10,000 deposit in your bank account, it's reported to the government. You have to refill out a form. People didn't care. The average working Joe ain't depositing $10,000 in a bank account. Nobody stopped and said, well, really, is this something we should be letting them get into, turning the banks into snitches for the government? Nobody cared. They're trying to stop the drug kingpins. You're looking back on it, it was absurd on his face, you know? The drug cartel guy that's got $50 billion in $100 bills shrink-wrapped on pallets in his secret underground tunnel. He's going to be like, man, we're a little short on the payment this week. We're going to have, you know, we got to pay the bank this week. We got to make a utility payment. We got to pay our utility bill on this compound, and it ain't cheap. So they go down into the tunnel, and they cut the shrink wrap off and get $10,000 worth of these cash. Still smell like cocaine on them, and go down and deposit it in the bank so they can pay their electric bill. Stupid. But that was what they told everybody. Crack down the drug kingpins. And of course, now they take that, and now we're at $600. $600. $600 is going to keep billionaires from not paying their taxes. It's going to keep drug kingpins from being... drug kingpins. Going to get them all in line by cracking down on you and your $600, snitching on you to the government. When I was watching all this play out on the TV, I got confused because I didn't realize that Janet Yellen is now like the head of the Treasury Department. So I thought, well, what's she on there? She's not the head of the Federal Reserve anymore. But you see, she was the head of the Federal Reserve, but now she's chosen to be the head of the Treasury Department. They all just revolving door around, you know, these people, they revolving door around. Now she's the head of the Treasury Department. Talking about, we've got this justification for your $600. It's not about tax, man. It's easy to hear about this and be like, yeah, once again, they're just going to scalp money off the working man. And I guess that's true to a certain extent, but I don't think that's the really, you know, that's just like a minor benefit. I mean, let's be honest. At this point, we know the government's never paying back the debt they owe. I mean, that's a joke. It's just not. Cracking down, snitching on people's bank accounts isn't going to pay this government debt. That's unpayable. We all know it's unpayable. I think it's much more insidious than that. It's about control. It's always about control. You hear about people, and you see this a lot now, and there's help wanted signs. There's restaurants that are, you know, the dine-in area is closed, and you ask them, well, why is only the drive-through open? And they'll tell you, well, we can't get no help. We can't get no hands. We can't get no employees. There's help wanted signs everywhere, and we have horrible unemployment. Now, people will just simplistically dismiss this and say, oh, people magically got lazy now and don't want to work. We did a whole show on that notion. But what if part of it is more and more people discovered that, you know, they can do side hustle jobs, you know? You can go help lay concrete all day and they pay you in cash. You don't have to, you know, by the time you don't, yeah, if you figured it by the hour, at first it may not look like you're making that much money. But when you figure in that you're not paying all of those other little, you know, FICAs and crap that they take out, you're just getting paid in cash, you're coming out pretty good. And you can kind of set your own hours. People are figuring out side hustles, they can't have that. They're in the process of imploding the economy to make everybody dependent on a government allowance of some sort. They can't have you operating in cash. They can't have you figuring out that, you know, you can operate outside of the system and do okay for yourself. They got to have you dependent. Crack down. Not let you have that $600. We're going to stop these billionaires from not paying taxes by cracking down on $600 deposits in the bank. Now, remember, their stated plan is that you will own nothing. Forget the you'll be happy with it part. That's just window dressing they threw on there. Their openly stated plan is that you will own nothing, which means that they will own everything. You'll own nothing. Now, if you're going to own nothing, that means you're basically going to be living on some kind of little government allowance. They can't have you taking the government allowance and then working for cash, because then you can take that cash and buy something. You're going to own nothing. You're all going to be renters. I mean, you're going to be renting everything. You won't own a damn thing. They're going to own everything. You're just going to be allowed to use it. Then when you die, they take it back and give it to somebody else. Ultimate control. Ultimate control. People are going to have to learn. And say, I think this plan is stupid, by the way. I think because people will find a workaround. People find a workaround. That's why they want to implement a cashless society, because they're worried about cash being a workaround of this ultimate control grid. Remember, taxes is secondary. That's just the excuse. It's about the control. The primary objective, I believe, here is the control. People find a workaround. They got to get to a cashless society. Because, see, white people at some point in time are going to have to learn from the Mexicans. Let me tell you something. I live in Texas, and we've been living alongside Mexicans for generations. This place was existed. And let me tell you, Mexicans work in cash, by and large. They operate on cash. They go in a place. They don't use it. It's white people that go in everywhere and use check card. Buy $1.99 soda water. It's like, that's going to be $1.99. I put it on my check card. Put it on my credit card. That's a white people thing. And it's retarded. Don't be using your check card or your credit card for no damn $1.99. Put some cash in your pockets, you fool. See, the Mexicans, they go in and it's like, that'll be $1.99. And they're like, I got $100. You know, I mean, they're paying with cash. They operate in cash. White people all be like, you know, man, them Mexicans, they come over here. They get on these government benefits. They don't question why the government gives these out. That's not a problem. The problem is these people take it. They take what's offered. That's the problem. But white people be like, these people come over here, get the government benefits, and then what do? They go out there and work for cash. Well, hell, they wind up with more money. They're not paying for anything. Government's paying for everything for them, and then they're working in cash. You're going to have to get that mindset because the crackdown is coming. The crackdown is a-coming. The ultimate control grid is coming. You better start getting a Mexican mindset where you're going to be willing to operate in cash. You're going to be willing to barter. You're going to be willing to trade. Hey, I can do this work for you if you can do this work for me. Otherwise, your other choice is going to be to eat the bug paste, live in your pod, get your government allowance. Ultimate, live under the ultimate control grid. You're going to have to get rid of that mindset that, oh, these people, they should be like me. They should be letting the government monitor every single thing I do. How dare they operate in cash? Like I say, the government wants to eliminate cash for this very reason. I don't see how that's practical. I would say that's practical. Well, you'll be paying with an app on your smartphone. Okay. But you're going to make cash disappear? Is that really very realistic? Will there not be a workaround? There's always good. They think they have more control than what they do. They have a higher opinion of themselves than what is warranted. Speaking of the lies, I saw a ridiculous thing the other day on the network news. And they had some, I don't know, rando doctor on there. It's obviously very intelligent because his name was something Indian that I can't pronounce. And this guy actually had the nerve to be on here talking about, you know, like after around the first year, next year, we're going to be more or less back to normal. We're turning the corner finally. I was sitting here, I probably looked insane because I'm sitting in a room by myself watching this and I'm like laughing out loud hysterically because it's so ridiculous. Yes, I think that we do see the light at the end of the tunnel if everybody would just continue to get vaccinated. And yes, this is after he made the point that somehow unvaccinated people are causing the vaccinated people to get sick. Yes, he did say that. That is part of the official narrative. Vaccinated people are getting the deadly virus because of the unvaccinated people are giving it to them. But the vax totally works. It's totally safe, totally effective. Just causes 1 in 8 women to have a miscarriage if they're pregnant, but it's totally safe for pregnant women. Just think of it as an involuntary abortion. And say abortion is good, according to the narrative. You see, you're actually contributing to the good by aborting your unborn children. But anyway, getting back on point, he was talking about with a straight face. Well, I say with a straight face, actually thinking back, he was kind of laughing when he said it. Maybe he couldn't say it with a straight face. But he was saying, we're turning the corner, and by next year, we really should be back to some form of normal if everybody will continue to get vaccinated. You know, it's one thing for someone to have some years on them, such as myself, and for me to talk about, look, I remember when they were talking global cooling back in the 70s, you know. You can say, oh, I remember when they were pushing global cooling, new ice age back in the 70s. It was one thing that you got all these people that were born after that, and they don't remember that. They just have to take my word for it. But it's something else entirely to say, expect people to forget that a freaking year and a half ago, you were saying 2 weeks to flatten the curve. 2 weeks. Everybody's going to get sick. We just don't want to overrun the hospitals. We got to have people come in evenly. We're flattening the curve. They were telling everybody, this was back when the narrative made more sense. They were telling everybody that You know, you got to be, we got to have everybody come in evil. We can't just have everybody like bum rushing the hospitals at once. A zombie apocalypse of all these people falling dead from the deadly virus. And every people doing that, we got to flatten the curve. That's all we're doing, 2 weeks to flatten the curve. And now here we are. And with a straight face, we'll be back to some form of normal next year. If everybody gets vaccinated, we're not going to be at a normal next year. We're going to be in clown world, the same place we're at now, probably more clownish. If you don't figure out that when cold and flu season gets here, and it's a coming, baby, we're getting well into the fall. If you haven't figured out by now that we're getting more lockdowns blamed on the deadliest virus known to man, then I don't know what to tell you. You're in for disappointment, I guess. If you think we're not doing lockdowns this year, yes, you will be doing lockdowns. And yes, they will be blaming the vax refusers. You'll be demonized. They'll have more sticks out to whack you with. I was asked some time back, and I didn't have a good answer at the time. I was asked some time back, at what point did you know that this whole pandemic narrative was bullshit? At what point in time? Did you know? And I didn't have an answer because it's like an accumulation. You see this and it's like, that don't look right. And then this and then this and then this and this. At some point in time, it's undeniable bullshit, the narrative they're feeding us. But I was thinking about, you know, what was probably the first big red flag? Because I didn't really have a good answer at the time. And I kind of fumbled it. You know, it's like the handoff and I kind of fumbled the ball. I was able to throw myself down on the ball on the field and get piled on and hold possession. But I didn't have a good answer. But it doesn't mean I didn't continue to reflect on it. And reflecting on it, I think the first big red flag for me that, hey, this is probably bullshit. Because you remember, when this broke out, everybody was like, we don't know. I mean, all we know is what they're telling us. And they're saying this new thing has broke out in the Wuhan. And this deadly pandemic and people are dying and people are falling over. And just it's going to be mass death on the streets. Seemed a little over the top, but we didn't know. And I said at the time, we don't know. This thing may be a big deal. We don't know. All we can do is go off of what they're telling us. Maybe bullshit. Winds up it was bullshit. But nonetheless, looking back, I think one of the first big red flags that came up for me was right after this kicked off. And they were saying this deadly pandemic has broke out in China. It's going to wipe off the entire population of the planet. There's going to be corpses stacked up everywhere, just going to be tripping over dead bodies from this deadly, deadly, deadly virus. And China, like, shuts down the entire city. They do a massive quarantine. Now, they're telling us this is a deadly, deadly virus, and you see China shutting down the whole city, and they're treating it serious. They're shut the whole bitch down, and they got people locked down in quarantine, not letting anybody in, nobody out, people walking around hazmat suits. This looks like the real deal. And what does the U.S. government do? What does Trump do? He was president at the time. They send planes over into the quarantine zone. This is a deadly virus. If it spreads, if it's allowed to spread to the entire planet, it's going to wipe everybody out. Thankfully, it wound up not being the case. But this is what they're telling us. We didn't know. We had graphic footage of biohazard suits and a complete lockdown in China. U.S. government sends airplanes over there and picks up Americans and brings them back with the virus. You have to wonder, you know, all this talk of, you know, labs, and did it come from a lab? Was it released by the U.S.? Was it released by, who was it released by? All of that stuff, which I don't care to get into because I think it's a distraction. But you can't help but to wonder if it was released by the U.S. government. Maybe there was a reason they were so desperate to get over there and get those Americans out of there before they could be questioned. But that's a point for another day. I think that looking back, the big red flag, the first real big red flag that this was bullshit was they flew planes into the quarantine zone to evacuate Americans and bring them back here with the deadly disease. The one thing you wouldn't do. Well, we can't have our Americans losing their freedom being stuck in China. Jing Jongs may just take their freedoms away. Yeah, they may have a deadly virus, but they may not be able to do gay anal. We got to have them here where they're free. Because our freedoms and our democracy, there's nothing better reflected in that than nonstop gay anal. This is just utterly absurd. They're telling us that this is this deadly pandemic, and then they fly into the quarantine zone. and load up people and bring them here. And now, lo and behold, we got people here in the U.S. It's spreading like wildflower, like wildfire in the U.S. Well, where, I guess it had to have come here from the people you flew in on the plane out of the quarantine. Out of the quarantine zone. First big red flag. It's all bullshit. It's bullshit. Don't worry, though. 2 weeks to flatten the curve. Wear your mask. Get your vaccine. And now that you got your vaccine, put on more masks. Oh, and now you're going to have a booster shot every so often. I love how they say with a straight face that the vaccine is totally effective. And according to their data, the effectiveness of it lasts for up to 7 months. It's real effective. Of course, while they bury the side effects. I hate it. Too much COVID talk. Too much doom virus talk on the show this week. It's ultimately about control. We're going to circle back out of just talking about the doom virus and back to the control. It all ties together, though, doesn't it? You look at the measures they've taken in the name of the virus. Whether it's in the name of the virus, because the virus is just an excuse now. I mean, it's obvious. Early on, I'm pretty forgiving. So early on, like I said, hell, when it first started, I was like, we don't know. This could be a big deal. Maybe it is. I don't know. We can just go off what they tell us. But at some point in time, it becomes undeniable what this is about. And it's about control. And whether they use the virus as a justification or the shocking revelation that billionaires don't pay any taxes, so they're going to have to monitor your $600 deposits in the bank. It's all about control. They've taken basically all of your rights away now. You really don't have, because once you surrender your bodily autonomy, your right to that you have authority over your children and over your own body, then you have no rights. Don't sit there and talk about my second, my this amendment, my that amendment. When they can force you or your kids to get vaccinated against your will, you ain't got any rights. Pfizer's all excited. They're getting ready. They're going to get authorization to start giving the shots to five-year-olds and up. That even by their own statistics have virtually, you know, statistically pretty much no danger of the deadly virus beyond it just getting sick. But they're going to administer this to the children. It's about control. It's about control. They can make you do anything. Now they can keep you from having your job. Now you're going to get fired for not having the vaccine. It won't be long. Won't be able to go to the store without the vaccine. That's your proof. And your proof is going to be on your app because papers can be forged. Got to have it on your phone. Won't be able to deposit money in the bank. Without it being reported, the bank will be your snitch to the government. Can't have you working side jobs. You can't work without the vaccine. If you can go do jobs for cash, then you won't be proving you're vaccinated. That's all about control. They want to control every aspect of your life. If you've ever watched cattle being worked, the cattle start off out there in the pasture, roaming around, doing their thing. They're still pinned in, but they feel pretty free. They're out there on 100 acres, wandering around, grazing, shading up in the day, chewing their cud. Life is good as a cow. And then they start herding the cows along. Herding the cows along, there's several ways. You get this picture that they herd cows, they get out there on horseback, and they work them in. That's usually for the stragglers, you see. They start off with the carrot. It's the carrot and stick approach. Your cattle, for the most part, when you gather cattle, you go out there in the pickup or on the four-wheeler, and you honk the horn, and they're so trained, they want to be fed. They chase the pickup, and you just drive the pickup up into the pen, and it's a big pen. It don't feel like a little pen. You just drive into the pen, honk the horn, and they all run in there. They all run in there. And then you shut the gate. Don't give them no cow cubes. Got them where you want them. You got them in the pen. You got them manageable now. Now, yeah, you might have to go out on horseback because you got some stragglers out there don't want to come in. They're like, I don't care about your cattle cubes. You see, right now, those that are refusing the vaccine, they're the stragglers. See, then they send the cowboys out. And the cowboys go out there and start pushing them. You start pushing them. And they know this running around going yee-haw, yee-haw, twirling the rope around. That shit's on TV. You just get along and you just start pushing them. You get them up along the fence and you push them along down the fence. You just kind of herd them along nice and easy. And you have somebody down there. And when they start getting close to the gate, they open the gate. And then you just push them down. And before they know it, they're into the pen with the rest of the cattle. Now that they're in the pen, Then you start putting, okay, you want to cut out the steer. You gotta cut calves. That means you're cutting their balls off. You're making them steers. They're not bull calves anymore. They're going to be steers. And so you start cutting them out and you put them into a smaller pen. And ultimately they wind up funneled into a chute where a single one is in there, and you put them in the squeeze chute and cut their nuts off one at a time. But they started off out here. Then you get them into a smaller containment field, a smaller containment pen, big pen at first. They still feel like, you know, they don't panic. They don't feel like they're trapped because they're in a pen, but it's a big pen. And then you start pushing the ones you want over here into the smaller pen. The pens get smaller and smaller and smaller until you're one sorry ass little bull calf stuck in a squeeze chute and somebody's cutting your nuts off. It's the way it works. It's the control. You see this same basic thing being applied to society today. Everybody out there, they think they got freedoms. They're still pinned up, but they still have a sense of freedom. And now being pushed in. Most of them, a whole bunch of them ran when they honked the horn and chased and went and did whatever they were told because they believe in it. But now they're gathering up the stragglers, making it harder and harder. They're gathering up the stragglers. And we're being pushed into smaller and smaller pens. You don't have the right to do this now. You got to do this. You can't do this unless you do what we tell you to. We're slowly being pushed into smaller and smaller pens. And you will wind up in a squeeze chute getting your nuts cut off. That's where, maybe not literally, but you get the point. As the pid gets smaller and smaller. By the time you realize that there's no freedom here, they pushed you into a smaller, smaller pen. Now you're in the squeeze chute. And you can't move until they release it. You are in absolute, complete control of them. You can't move. We're all in the pen. They're shoving us into the pen. And it goes smaller and smaller and smaller pens. They're getting greater and greater and greater control. And you still have people running around talking about, America, we got our freedoms, let me tell you. What freedoms? You're in the pen now. You're not even out in the field where you're out in the pasture where you're pretending that, you know, you feel like you have a certain amount of autonomy because you got a pretty big area, fairly wide area to roam around in. You're in the pen now. They can tell you that you got to, you can't work unless you do this. You can't do this. We're going to force you to get this. We're going to force your kids to do that. And we're going to do this. They have absolute control over every aspect of your life. You're in the pen. You're under their control. You got to get in touch with reality. We got to get into the Christian specifics message this week. The sermon, if you would. So, yeah, you know what to do. Let's get after that now. You know what to do. Get in there, fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon here at the Parish of the Patriots. So, yeah, as we get settled in this week, I have a confession to make. It's confession time. I have a confession to make. Normally, when we sit down or before we sit down for a Christian specific segment, I at least have a vague idea of what we're going to talk about. I've got something jotted down beforehand. Like during the week, I spend time in prayer and reflection and trying to seek the truth. And I'll usually wind up with something I'm like, this will be good to discuss on the show. This week, I got nothing. I mean, I had to sit here for a while. And to be like, well, what are we going to talk about? But thank goodness we do. I did finally come up with something I think we'll discuss. And usually one of my favorite books of the Bible, Ecclesiastes. We can always fall back on good old Ecclesiastes for some great content. And hopefully you'll get something out of it. But I do got to admit, this was kind of just almost like a last minute. What are we going to talk about? What can we discuss this week? You know, I mean, I can always talk about judgment and hellfire and brimstone and how a lot of people are going to hell, especially in this time of judgment. But that gets a little old hearing that week in and week out. So I want to spice it up. I do want to have some variety here. I want to keep it somewhat interesting. So we're going to look at Ecclesiastes. We're going to do several verses. Most of what we're going to do, I think, will be in chapter 7. We're going to reference back to chapter 6. But we'll start with Ecclesiastes 7 and just kind of work our way along from there. And we're liable to talk about several different things, but I think what we're going to mostly focus on this week is the concept of having a good name, about your name. And of course, we tend to think, and, you know, as it, because of our modern society, if you say, well, you know, you reference somebody's name, you just simply think about, you know, what they're called. What's that? You know, you say a good name. Bob has a good name. Well, it's not when that old saying, you'd say Bob has a good name. It don't mean, wow, the name Bob has a really nice ring to it, doesn't it? Bob. I like the way it rolls off the tongue. Bob. But that's not what people mean. When people would say back in the day, I guess people probably still use that expression to a certain extent, but less so. But when people would say Bob has a good name, they would say, well, they just meant he had a good reputation. And this kind of gets to the heart of the matter. And we'll kind of reference this from a Bible, a biblical perspective, if you would, this week. So we're going to start off with Ecclesiastes chapter 7. We're just going to start at verse 1 for now. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Now, a good name is better than precious ointment. Again, we're not saying Bob rolls off the tongue really nice, so that name is really nice. We're talking about, what does it mean? What does it mean to have a good name? Now, I want to jump back here and reference, we'll back up a chapter to Ecclesiastes 6. Let's do verses 3 through 4 to really drive down on this notion of a name in a biblical sense. If a man beget 100 children and live many years, so that the days of his years be many, and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than he. In other words, a child that's not born into the world, a child that is, that's existence ends in a miscarriage is what he's talking about. A stillborn child when he says an untimely birth. For he cometh in with vanity and departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. His name shall be covered with darkness. Now, perhaps, since we're still referencing a miscarriage, a stillborn child, a child that never got to live in the world, the mother may have already picked out a name. I was going to name this child, you know, whatever, Stephen. I don't know, just grabbed a random name. I already used Bob, so I was going to use that. But you would say, well, you know, she already had a name picked out for her stillborn or miscarried child. But it says here, his name shall be covered with darkness. They'll never know. In other words, the child may have been given a name already by its mother, but that's not the name we're talking about. That's just she had something that the child will be called, be referenced by. Its name will be covered in darkness. Why? Because it never lived. It never got a chance to do things, make decisions. So your name is the accumulation of the decisions you make, the choices you make, and the things that you accumulate and do in your life. See, this brings you to your name, who you are. What have you done? The stillborn child never got a chance to do anything, never got a chance to make choices, never got a chance to make an impact on the world. Its name is covered in darkness because it never got to do anything. Doesn't matter that the mother might have a burial for it and say, here lies my stillborn child that I named Stephen. It doesn't matter. That's just what it was going to be referenced. Their name is covered in darkness. They never got to do anything. Nobody knew them by their deeds, by their choices, the accumulation. What's your name? What have you done your whole life? One of the things when you think about it in this sense, I don't know, I guess sort of a relief, is it's a cumulative thing. You know, what is the summary of your life? We all know that nobody in this world is without sin. There's no perfect people. You see, your name isn't defined by the mistakes you have made necessarily. It's the accumulation. If you put everything together, how have you lived your life? I mean, look, we all know you've screwed up. We know you've made bad choices. You've probably taken completely wrong turns in life that might have taken you a while to get back from. But what is the grand total? What is the summary? What is the summary of your life and how you've lived? What you've done? What choices have you made? When you run into people that are bitter about their lives, and I've run into people that are even bitter towards God, you probably have as well. They'll say blasphemous things, it's very apparent that they're directing their anger towards God. And usually, if you talk to these people long enough, you'll come to the realization that what they're unhappy about is their life, the summary of their life, where they're at. They're not happy with their life, and it's God's fault. It's God's fault that our lives are what they are. One of the hardest things to accept. One of the hardest things to accept and is that your life, for the most part, your life is what it is. You live the way you live, and your circumstances are what they are as a result of the choices you have made, as a result of what your name is. Your life kind of is a reflection of your name. You make your cumulative choices and they add up. You make all these little choices, and maybe, you know, yes, you can wind up making big choices that have a big impact on your life and change the very direction of your life. But for the most part, your life is made up of all these little choices that when you put them all together, you know, that's what your life is. For instance, if a woman decides to, you know, pursue a career and education and these things, and she pursues this message of the world that says this is where you're going to find happiness. So she makes these cumulative choices and she does the things that the world says this is going to bring you happiness, which of course winds up being a lie. And she does these things, and then she wakes up one day and she's 45 years old, childless, and she finds herself bitter because she realizes she never had any children. She's really angry because she didn't have any children, and it just doesn't seem fair. Now, granted, a certain amount of responsibility falls on the fact that she was lied to by society, but the fact of the matter is she is where she is because of the cumulative decisions she made. She's 45 and childless and never going to have any children of her own. And it's a result of the choices she made. It always comes back to choices. Satan lies to us. I'm kind of getting off on a tangent. I'm going to reel it back in here in a minute. But this point I've made before, and I think it's really important for everyone to understand and always incorporate it into your mindset. Satan's going to tempt you. He'll lie to you. He'll try to deceive you. He'll try to trick you, but he cannot take your choice away from you. He is the accuser. He wants to accuse you before God. He can't accuse you if he were like grab you and strong arm you and physically force you to do something against your will. He cannot accuse you. The whole point is to accuse you. There's always a choice. There's always a choice. See, the choice is yours. He may lie to you, may be deceived, he may trick you or whatever, but you always ultimately have the choice. And our lives wind up being made up of the cumulative choices we've made. And so it is with our name. If you've made the choices over and over and over again in your life, accumulating these choices to say, steal from somebody, you'll steal. I knew somebody one time, and I was talking to their family members. This says something about how family will defend you. And this family member was referencing this person and telling me about this person that's in their family. And they said, oh, he's just as good as he could be. He's just a really good person. And then they added, now he'll steal anything that ain't nailed down. But I mean, he's a great guy. He'll give you the shirt off his back. Well, of course, it's not his shirt. He stole somebody else's shirt. I think it's a funny commentary on how we'll ultimately defend family. It sounds absurd, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, if people will say you're a great person, but you're a thief, they'll kind of stick with you through anything. That's kind of something you can take a certain amount of, confidence in, a certain amount of something you can count on, I guess. But anyway, getting back on point. If you make the choices over and over in life to be the type of person that'll steal anything that ain't nailed down, if somebody asks you, the average person asks, you know, if somebody asks the average person who knows you that's not family, is going to say that you're a great guy, they're going to say, well, who is that guy? And somewhere in there, they're going to say what? Well, he's a thief. He'll steal anything that isn't nailed down. Who's that guy? He's a thief. That's your name. You made the cumulative decision all through your life to steal, that you'll take things that aren't yours. So what are you known by? I mean, sure, they may say your name's Bob, but really what people know you as, you're that thief. You're that guy who'll steal anything that isn't nailed down. You're that guy that people don't leave their stuff laying around because you'll pick it up, put it in your pocket. That's your name. That's who you are. You may not like it. If you don't like it, you realize that everybody knows you as that sorry ass thief that lives down the road. Don't be mad at everybody else. That's your name. You made it. It's made of the decisions, the accumulation of the decisions you've made in your life. If you choose to steal from people over and over and over and over again, then you're going to be known as a thief. That's going to be your name. This is reflected in the fact that when this concept of the name, of who you are, It's reflected in the fact, one of the things I always point out, probably pretty much every week, because I think it's so important. When they ask Jesus, who are you? What's your name? He didn't say, my name's Jesus. I come from over there, next county over, my name's Jesus. He didn't say that. He says he's the way, the truth, the life. He told them who he is. Who are you? What are you doing here? What's your purpose? What's your name? Way, the truth, and the life. Your name is who you are, what you do. And people are going to identify who you are by what you do. By what you do, how you live your life. Who's Jim? You know Jim? Oh, yeah. He's that alcoholic. He's that guy. He's that drunk. He's that drunk. He's had like 58 DWIs. You're going to be known as that drunk. And you may think that's not fair. You may say, well, there's more to me than just being a drunk. And that may be true. But you see, your cumulative decisions, the thing everybody knows you by, your name is Jim the Drunk. You're the drunk. Lives down the street. Let's continue on here. I was going to get into more of this, and I've already eaten up quite a bit of time. So we're just going to go ahead and start all over here at chapter 7, verse 1, and this time we'll keep going. A good name, because I wanted to reread this first verse, because I think after having this discussion, it makes more, it has a harder impact. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. So in other words, you find wisdom in the house of mourning. And when he says house of mourning, he's basically talking about when there's a death. You know, and you probably have experienced a certain amount of this in your life. If you've ever been to a funeral, you know the difference between going to a funeral and saying going to a wedding. Although the two, the two could be very similar depending on your experience in life. But, but no, if you go to a wedding or a celebration of some sort, you know, you notice the difference because everybody's laughing, da 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 da. And what are people talking about? They're talking about, you know, trivial things. What's going on? Oh, you know, da da da. Not much at all. There's not a lot of wisdom there. I mean, it's nice. Everybody's in a good mood. But now, when you go to a funeral, there ain't nobody joking and laughing and talking about trivial things. There's a somber mood. Everybody is quiet. Everybody is respectful. Everybody puts a little more effort into the prayer. Why? Because you're reminded your turn is coming. Everybody gets a turn in the box. You're reminded that our time here is very, very temporary. You start taking things a little more seriously. You go to a funeral, like the whole rest of the day, you don't walk out of the funeral and then you're like, whoo, glad that's over. I mean, well, you might, but you go the rest of the day for the most part, you know, like you take things more seriously because in the back of your mind, you're thinking, what am I doing? What am I doing with my life? What am I going to be? What will I have accomplished at the end of this thing? I think it's interesting that it says the day of death is better than the day of one's birth. You know, at the birth, you've got it all ahead of you. It's like, what are you going to do? At your day of death, you're finished. You're fine. Good, bad, in between. The task is done. I think I made the offhand remark last week. Like if people say, you know, do you think God would like do reincarnation? And my reaction is always, I hope not. I think I have to do this crap all over again. People always say, you know, would you go back in time? You know, as you get older, you'll find yourself reflecting or you'll talk to people your own age and they'll say, man, if I could just go back and be 19 again, if I go back and be 16 in high school again. I've known people that say that. If I could just go back and be young again, wouldn't you go back and be young again? My response has always been something along the lines of only if I could take my current brain with me. I wouldn't want to have to go back and learn all those hard lessons again. On the day of your death, you're done learning the hard lessons. You've learned what you're going to learn. You know, the day of birth, you're facing trouble and turmoil, which makes up what seems like a lot of man's life. Picking up here, verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. We are made stronger by trial and trouble. sadness. You take things more seriously. We kind of already covered that. You take things more seriously. If you go to a funeral, you're taking things seriously. You realize it's not a time of joking and laughing and messing around and thinking of trivial thoughts. You're not thinking of trivial thoughts. You're thinking about your time in the box. It may be way in the back of your mind, but you're thinking of it. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. Surely oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. Better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Say not thou, what is the cause, that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. Let's run back through what we just read, just really quickly, because there's kind of a lot to unpack just in these few short verses. Jumping back here to verse 7, surely oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. Because this is a verse that's probably pretty easy to kind of misunderstand or to skip over and not really grasp the meaning. Oppression maketh a wise man mad. When you live in corrupt times, even a wise man can be corrupted. When it says a gift destroyeth the heart, what they're not talking about, you know, oh, you got a Christmas present from your grandma. It's destroying your heart. That's not what he's saying. By a gift, they're talking about think of it in terms of like taking a bribe. You see, somebody might turn off wise, but when you live in corrupt times, you might be a wise man. But if you live in corrupt times, you're going to be tempted. And when you take the bribe and then, you know, to deny justice, it corrupts your heart. It destroys your heart. Once you take the bribe, then it's like a cancer that begins eating you up. Even a wise man is not immune to this. A wise man should avoid this. But you see, oppression maketh a wise man mad. As somebody who might be once mad, when you live in corrupt times, it can drive you mad. And the wise man becomes as the fool. Better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Once something's over with, when you're going through some kind of bullshit in your life, would you not agree that the end of it is better than the beginning? When you can look back on something, you're going through some kind of trial or tribulation, and when it's finally over, you take this deep breath and you're like, thank goodness, that's over with. I'm finally done with that. The end of it is better than the beginning. And the patient of spirit. You see, you can get too caught up. When you're caught up in some kind of trouble in your life, it brings turmoil. You feel turmoil in your spirit. But it says here, the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. The patient waits on God. The patient is able to say, well, I'll see where God is going to take me next. You have to be patient. You have to be patient in your spirit and understand that at some point this, whatever you're going through, is going to come to an end. It's guaranteed it will come to an end. Whatever trouble you're having, no matter how bad it is, there will be an end to it at some point. You have to be patient, in spirit. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. There's a lot of wisdom in that single verse, isn't there? If you look back on your life, and again, the older you are, the more you have to look back on, very seldom, if ever, did you make a good decision when you were really pissed off. I mean, isn't that the truth? I mean, you might have that's not to say there's not times when it is 100% completely justifiable to be angry. They're not saying that. It's just that you're not going to make your best decisions when you're angry. For that matter, you can apply this to all your emotional states. You might be with some girl and you just love her and you can't picture your life being without her and you just got to be with her and she's everything in your life and you would do anything. That is not the time to marry that bitch because your judgment is clouded. You better wait till you've been around her and been with her long enough to where you can step back from all that and be like, is this somebody I really want to spend my life with? What kind of choices does she make? What kind of track record does she got? What's her name? What kind of name has she established for herself by her accumulated decisions? Is this somebody that I really want to tie myself to? You're in that emotional state. Don't trust yourself. It's the same with anger. You look back on your life. I can just about guarantee you never made your best, most wise decisions when you were lashing out in anger. If you're angry about something, I'm not saying there's not times you're justified being angry. Probably a lot of times you're justified in being angry. You're going to make your best decision. Your boss really pisses you the hell off. If you jump up, throw the table over and says, take this job and stick it up your ass and walk out the door, you may feel better at that moment. But the prudent and wise decision would be to bite your tongue and maybe wait a few days. Get over it. Calm down. Now, after you've gotten over your anger and you can think about it, if you like, you come to the conclusion, like, I don't need this job. I don't have to take this shit. I can go do something else. Then you can rationally and calmly go in and say, I quit. See you later. And walk out. It's the same end result, but you see, you can make that decision with confidence. You're not being influenced by your anger. Because if you flip the table over, tell him to stick the job up his ass and walk out, you might wake up the next day and be like, well, that was real smart. Now I have no job, no money in the bank. And, you know, I got all these payments due. What the hell am I going to do? And now you may be regretting. You can't go back after that big show and be like, hey, I'm really sorry about that. You know, can I have my job back? You just look like an idiot. See, it's best to make the decision. You might have made the end result wind up being the same, that you quit your job. But you're going to feel a lot better about it and a lot more confident that it was a good decision if you didn't make it in a moment of anger. You'll get over that. You'll get over the moment of anger. Nobody's saying your anger isn't justified. You just need to get over that so that you can make a calm, calculated, rational decision. And finally, say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. Again, I think this is something that will apply to people more as you get older. You know, the whole thing where older people talk about the good old days. You know, the good old days. It becomes real tempting to look back on the good old days. Why were things better in the past than they are now? Why was my life better in the past than what it is now? Again, this circles back to our initial point with your life, for the most part, is what it is because of the decisions you've made. It's foolish to say, oh, well, the old days were better. Well, you condemn yourself with that because your days today, for the most part, I'm not talking about like external forces like Clown World. But for the most part, your life is what it is because of the decisions you've made. Now, the thing you have to take into account here is we're going to wrap up here pretty quick. But the thing you have to always take into account, too, is that your life, if you're truly seeking the Lord, you seek the Lord and you try to find, you know, the path he has set out for you, you're going to make mistakes. There's going to be times you're going to abandon that and go off on your own and do dumb shit. But ultimately, your life winds up where you're at. And if you're following the Lord, you are going to wind up where God wants you to be. I really do truly believe that. You can look back on your life. If you're right now at a spot where, you know, you're pretty confident you're doing what God wants you to do. You're living your life the way God wants you to live it. You're feeling closer. You're seeking him. You're getting a greater understanding. More than likely, if you look back, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be where you are if you hadn't made those mistakes. If you hadn't made those mistakes, you ultimately, it all came together. And now you're at where you're supposed to be, where God needs you to be, where God wants you to be, even when you factor in the mistakes. So when you go back and say, well, I shouldn't have done this and I should have done that. And wow, if I would have just stuck with this, it would have been better. The problem with that is if you're where God wants you to be now, if you did somehow say, oh, well, that was a mistake, you're essentially saying it's a mistake to be where you're at right now. That's not to say you shouldn't try to improve your life, but just understand that if you're ultimately on the path the Lord has set for you, then you're where you're supposed to be. There's no going back. There's no changing the past. It is a true vanity. It is absolutely pointless. You get all hung up in thinking, well, I should have, if I would have, if I could have. There's no meaning to it. It's gone. Time, It's linear. It's gone. It will never be again. What happened 20 years ago is never coming back. There's no point in sitting here thinking you woulda, coulda, shoulda. If you would have only, things would be better now. You don't know that. You don't have the foresight of God. You don't have the perspective of the eternal. You don't know what your life would have turned out if you had done this differently. I mean, you can sit where you're at now. If you'd only done this differently, things would be better. But you don't know that because other things fall in place. It's not accepting. It's a failure of accepting your perspective in this limited realm of time. You do not have an eternal perspective. Yes, you make choices that are good and bad in life. But very seldom, if ever, do those choices actually, you know, like are so huge that they change the absolute course of your life. It is possible. If you, I don't know, get angry and go kill somebody, then yeah, that's going to change your life forever in a permanent matter. One single decision. But for the most part, your decisions aren't that going to be that drastic. You look back and say, why were the days of old better? But were they really? And are you questioning where God has you to be right now? We got to wrap up on that note. I realize it's kind of random this week. And like I said, I didn't really have an overall message already kind of, you know, an outline. It's not like I sit here and write this stuff out. I usually have like at least one sentence written down. Oh, you know, well, I'll talk about how God this, that, you know, this scripture. I'm going to write down this scripture verse. We'll read that. At least have a starting point. So this week I kind of didn't. We just grabbed Ecclesiastes, found something good in it. And hopefully at the end of the day, you got something out of it. So yeah, we're going to go ahead. Like I say, we're going to wrap up, get on out of here. Thank you once again for those of you. Don't be shy. Pay those tithes. It is very much appreciated. And yeah, we'll see you right here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.